over Baghdad has been illuminated. We're seeing bright flashes going on all over the sky.
Hello and welcome to Radio Contra, the podcast of American Partisan and the home of the Mossy Oak Militia. I'm coming to y'all live from the G Camp in rural northern North Carolina. We're right here in the middle of it, on the brink of the storm, COVID-19, creating what I see as a perfect storm. Our liberties are once more in question and may vanish in total. Whole states, cities, locked down, streets empty, restaurants, no people. Everything seems to be a ghost town. And over what? This virus is bad, but it's not unlike anything we've faced in the past. And yet, here we are. I'm concerned for the direction that our country is going in, the direction that we're headed in as a people. I'm very concerned. And I believe that our nation, our way of life, is definitely not only under assault, but in danger of vanishing totally. One thing is for sure, that we're going to look back at this time and we're going to wonder about it. Stories are going to be written about it. That's for sure. It's not the virus itself, it's the reaction to it. And the reaction to what comes next, stock market losing an incredible amount of its value in over a week. What's next week going to look like? The layoffs have already started. The slowdown has already started. It's exposed the underlying problems, not only socially, but economically. We've kicked the can down the road one too many times, folks. And here we are. It is very disturbing for some of the news that I've gotten, some of the images that I have seen so far, and it hasn't even begun yet. But with that said, tonight I've got an interview that I have recorded with a friend and a man who has taught classes for me in the past, and Lord willing, will be doing so in the future. He is a current serving 68 whiskey that is a combat medic. And tonight we're going to be talking about the individual first aid kit, the IFAC, what needs to be in it, and the procedure for you to address battlefield trauma. No, this is not a crash course in how to be a doctor, but this is a crash course in how to keep a casualty alive long enough to get them to a higher tier of care. With that said, this episode is brought to you by Palmetto State Armory. Guns, ammo, and accessories are kind of slim pickings these days, but these guys are doing everything they can, working around the clock to get you the best products possible. They're doing everything they can with regards to the virus, as well as the needs of the consumers that are out there. And best of all, they're not price gouging anyone, like Cheaper Than Dirt has done. Seriously. I was browsing around just seeing if anyone was price gouging on the net, looking for prices of different brands of ammo. They were trying to sell a 40 round box of Brown Bear Russian 7.62x39 for $66. Cheaper than dirt, you're lower than dirt. Seriously, I hope any of the listeners out there never, ever purchase anything from that low-life company again. But with that said, there's too many good companies out there to mention who are ethical, who want to put good products in your hands. And to them, I salute them. Palmetto State Armory is definitely one of them. In addition, tonight's episode is brought to you by American Partisan site affiliate MyMedic.com. MyMedic has a large number of name brand IFAT components on hand. You want these items, you're going to need them. And if the social breakdown continues, like I fear that it will, I pray that it doesn't. I pray every single night that it does not. But I also know that there's a number of people out there looking to take advantage of the chaos. The powers that be have gaslit it for a long time. And with that said, if this thing goes hot, you're going to need that tourniquet. You're going to need that MPA. You're going to need that hyphen chest seal. MyMedic.com. Check them out. They will get you squared away. And with that, here's the interview between myself and MegMedic. All right. We are sitting here with a friend, a great man, a Marine veteran, and a current 68 whiskey in the United States Army National Guard, and he has taught a basic combat lifesaver course, TC3, Tactical Combat Casualty Care, for Brushbeater Training and Consulting, and we plan on doing several more iterations of that course. But MegMedic, man, it's good to have you.
It's really great to be here. I've been listening since you started, and there's been a lot of good information on here, and I'm excited to get on here and talk about this, because in the world of prepping, there's a lot of misinformation when it comes to this side of the house, and a lot of rumors that I really wish would die out.
Yeah, I bet, man. I bet. So when you came down and you did TC3 class, one of the most common questions that I had, whether it was people that were emailing inquiries about the class or the people that were actually in the class, was simply defining an IFAC, because it's one of those things that keeps popping up, I guess, in the prepperverse.
Mm-hmm.
Prepper sphere, the prepper universe.
And yeah,
I think that it's probably the most misunderstood, mislabeled term out there in the medical world. So if you want to just dive into what an IFAC is.
Yeah. I've definitely seen a lot of really weird IFAC lists online. So generally, an IFAC, coming from the military, is an individual first aid kit. And in and of itself, that is a bit of a misnomer, because when civilian people tend to hear first aid, they think of like a Red Cross, like first aid course, and like everything that entails, and like, oh, I got to treat for shock, and then like someone's having a heart attack, and all these other things. And that's not really what we're trying to deal with. So inside of, for lack of a better word, tactical medicine, and basically just treating people in a battlefield setting, what an IFAC is supposed to do is treat and provide treatment with what we call life-saving interventions. And the main ones that we like to use comes from a guideline, from TCCC guidelines, and from a mnemonic that, if you've heard about this before, called MARCH. And if you were at the class, I talked about this a lot. And that's massive hemorrhaging, airway, respirations, circulation, and then head hypothermia and everything else. And then there's further ones that they've come out with that kind of go on down the line from there and continuing treatment. But so for MARCH, that's going to be what we look at and how we treat those injuries and, you know, the biggest forms of preventable death on combat that we can. And those are massive hemorrhage, airway, and then basically hypothermia are the big three that we're concerned with. And then from there, it gets broken down upon treatment level, from all the way from, you know, a full surgeon to a PA, down to a special forces medic or a PJ, and then down on to my level at the regular line medic, and then further down to CLS, and then everybody else level. So the main things for what an individual should probably worry about for what they're putting in an IFAC is things that people are going to use to treat you. And that's the big thing I see with IFACs all the time is that, like, well, you know, if, you know, I roll up on something and, like, this is what I'm going to use to treat other people. No, full stop. Let me haul you right there.
Yeah.
Your IFAC is for other people to use on you. So, like, that's why even for, you know, in the tactical side, like, I don't care what you know how to do. This is for other people. So there might be other people that know a little bit more than you do showing up to treat you. So, like, if we're in a team together and we have a new guy that isn't quite ready to do a needle yet for a needle D, you and I know how to do something like that. Yeah. So we're going to include that in the IFAC because he's not using it on himself. No one's going to needle D themselves. And that's needle decompression for tension pneumothorax. And we'll get onto that later on down the line. But the biggest and first thing you need to do is at least one tourniquet. It kind of goes along that whole thing of, like, two is one and one is none. But they've done some research and found that, like, especially in the soft community where guys are rucking more and they're working out more and they're more physically fit, they tend to have a little bit bigger thighs. Following along that line of thinking is that you're going to need more pressure to occlude those vessels. So one of the things that they're pushing down now is that any lower appendage or lower extremity injury that requires a tourniquet gets two right off the bat. Like, we're not even worrying, well, is one going to work? Is we're just going straight to two because we're not playing that roll of the dice. So you need to have at least two on you for someone else to use, and hope to God you don't have more than one appendage that's hurting. So at least one tourniquet. And before we even get into this, I would just go ahead and say, stick with something that has been recommended by the Committee on TCCC. You can go on to a website. I'll send you the link so you can put it in the show notes. But it's Deployed Medicine.
Yeah.
And one of the lucky things that we have for us is, I want to say it was last year, they went ahead and, because they realized they hadn't done it in a while, and they looked at new tourniquets because a lot had come out since they last looked at tourniquets. A lot of new companies had put out stuff. A lot of new information had come out. And before, it was pretty much three main ones. And really all you saw at the small unit level was two main ones. And that was the Combat Application Tourniquet by North American Rescue and the Special Forces Field Tactical Tourniquet, the soft T wide. Before that, it was the plain soft T at only an inch. But then COTSI came out and said they wanted it to be at least 1.25 inches. They were going to say inch and a half, but that's a story for another day and time. So they came out with the soft T wide, which is inch and a half. So those are the big two that I would recommend people go with. There's a couple other ones that have come out down the line. I can't remember all of them. There's like six or seven now that are all recommended. And that's another thing that, getting into a little bit of the weeds here, but COTSI does not approve any sort of intervention, for use. They recommend them, for individuals and for units to use. So they don't do any studies themselves. They just review and analyze studies and look at the results of them and look at, you know, was this study really statistically relevant and a bunch of other sciencey things. So they've done a bunch of this research for us, so we don't have to go digging into the weeds. So I generally, when it comes to telling other people, and what I myself pack, are things that COTSI is going to recommend for other people. So the big two that you'll be easily able to find are the North American Rescue CAT and the Tactical Medical Solutions Soft T Wide. There are several others that fall under the recommended list from COTSI, that, and you would not be wrong by going with any of them. Just make sure you're familiar with it and you understand how to use it, because, like you said on an earlier episode, that under that moment of stress, you're going to fall back to the level of training that you mastered. And so being able to, you know, and that's, you know, when you're squirting blood out of your femoral artery, are you familiar enough with that tourniquet to be able to put it on properly, let alone at all, and be able to occlude that blood flow to get you to that next higher level of care? And that's kind of one of the things that breaks it up even further. Like, not all preparedness is doom and gloom, end of the world, you know, riots are breaking out because of coronavirus. Some of it's just you rolled up in a car accident and it was just one of those days. And that's another thing, is that it really depends on, you know, what kind of scenario are you preparing for, that will really guide how you want to pack and what size of bag you're going to use. Because I have bags that are set up for, okay, shit's popped off and we're doing area patrols in my neighborhood, and this is what I'm going to carry with me. And then there's, hey, I'm driving in my, you know, my Toyota down the road, and, you know, with my family, we were up on an accident, and this is what I'm going to grab, because it's a completely different setup, because they're two major different things. Because in one of them, I'm not worried about getting sued by somebody else by doing things that aren't covered by my EMT license that are covered by my military license for treating other service members. And those are two completely different things.
Right.
So I, again, start off with at least one tourniquet by a well-known manufacturer that has been reviewed and recommended by COTSI. Then from there, so that's going on down the March algorithm. The next one, we have airway. And for the lowest common denominator, the on-deployed medicine, there's a couple courses, and they're working on coming out with a whole bunch of them. Well, one of the ones they most recently released was the All Service Members course. This is for everybody from Joe Trigger Puller to the guy that works on your computer network at a S6. It was what it was designed to be. It was supposed to be across the entire DOD, because DOD came out with a guideline saying that everybody has to know TCCC before they deploy. It was a requirement that everyone had to learn TCCC. And that was what this was supposed to cover, is the basic thing that anybody would need to know to handle these situations, in case, you know, you send that random S6 guy out to the FOB to go replace, you know, your Nipper network, and all of a sudden you get attacked, and he might not necessarily have the same level of training you do, but you know that he understands the basics. And there's even a guideline on deployed medicine that breaks it down by level of what skills everybody should know. So on to that from next is, obviously, after massive hemorrhage, we have airway. And the thing for everybody to do, and what when I told my guys when we were downrange, and even before that, is there are certain things that I'm going to do to you regardless of whether or not you need them. And those are a saline lock and an MPA, because I don't know when you're going to need them. So I'd rather get them when I can before it's too late to get them and I have to go escalate to something higher. So for everyday Joe Blow, that's going to be a nasopharyngeal airway. It's a silicone tube that goes in your nose, goes on down, and it prevents your tongue from closing your airway. So that way, hey, you're conscious right now, but I have to go work on this other person, or I have to go do this other thing. Now I know that if something happens or you lose consciousness for whatever reason, your airway is secured. I don't have to worry about it. You're not going to die from asphyxiation.
Right.
Going on down the line,
MPAs are critical.
Oh yeah, they're huge. Later on, after we finish this, I'll get into like where to get equipment from, and I'll talk about that there. There are a couple people that I trust that are pretty good with their stuff, and one of them is not, for most things, Amazon.
You mean to tell me that the 15 cat tourniquets for 15 bucks is not a good deal?
It's a good deal if you're trying to cosplay for airsoft, then it's cool, but for serious use,
come on.
I would have to disagree with that.
so why not to get on the ship, but why wouldn't you do that if you want to elaborate on that? I mean, I know the answer, but for the listeners, Why might you not want to do that?
My issue with buying things off of Amazon is that you're not guaranteed that what you're purchasing is exactly what is being shown on that website. You can read through countless times and countless reviews of just like tennis shoes and this and that and all sorts of other random things. Like, I was looking at steel toes the other day for my my civilian job. And reading through, they were like, hey, beware that what you're purchasing isn't exactly what they're showing on the website. It's a little different, but it's pretty much the same. Well, when it comes to things I'm trusting my life to, I want exactly what I'm looking at and what exactly the description is saying that I'm purchasing to be what is delivering at my house and that I am paying my hard-earned money for. Because when your life depends on it, good enough is never that. You need it to be the best.
And so what would be the difference then between that $3 bargain bin tourniquet and something made by a quality company like North American Rescue?
It's going to come down to the quality of not only the fabric, the machining, and the biggest, most important thing that people always tend to overlook is the quality assurance and the quality control of the products that company is putting out. Yes, exactly. North American Rescue cats are, you know, $25 to $30 depending on where you look for them. But that's because they work. There are no second prizes right. for saving your life with cheaper pieces of equipment. There's no consolation prize for, oh, hey, you made that $3 one work. Good for you. There's just a, man, that sucks. You used a $3 one and it broke and you bled out and died. That's it. And when it comes to my life and the life of my family and those that I really hold most important in my life, I'm not cheaping out on any of that stuff because I'm not rolling that dice.
Yeah, exactly, man. Exactly. You know, the quality control and the quality of materials all the way down to the windlass, because I've seen where guys bought some cheap piece of junk tourniquet and we were using them not even in the real world, but just training
for training.
And guys were buying their own tourniquets. And, you know, we were going through tourniquet drills because we didn't want to use the expensive ones that the unit bought.
Yep.
And the windlasses are breaking. You're just like, throw that thing in the trash because it's a piece of shit. You know, I don't want that. I don't even want to risk confusing. Quality piece of gear for 10 pieces of crap in my kit. I don't want to do that, you know? So it's medical gear. Medical gear is one of those things that you should never, ever scrimp on.
Yeah, it's definitely a barrier to entry for me to play as an instructor because I refuse to even buy the fakes for training, for teaching people in class because they could look at that and be like, oh, so this is what a real tourniquet looks like, and then they'll go buy one online and it looks like the one they used in the class that I taught, and then they try to use it in the real world and it doesn't work. So everything that I use in class when it comes to tourniquets are 100% real. I might be getting them secondhand from other people that I trust, but I'm like, I'll buy used ones from people that they've used for training and stuff like that, but I'm never purchasing an off-brand or risky tourniquet for use for a training course. I absolutely refuse because I feel like it's a disservice to the students.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, you know, from an instructor's perspective, you have to show the students what right is supposed to look like.
Yeah. You don't show them what wrong is and then tell them this is what you're not supposed to do, because all they're going to remember is that's what you taught them. They're not going to remember specifically that this isn't what I'm supposed to do. You just tell them what they're supposed to do and let it go from there.
Yeah. Yeah, man. So we talked about tourniquets.
Yeah.
Kind of branching off of that a little bit. So you mentioned two different types. There's the cat tourniquet and the soft T, which I'm very intimately familiar with both.
Yep.
What would be the difference between the cat and the soft T tourniquet?
So the combat application tourniquet is different in several ways, mostly like kind of pedantic, small little things, because in essence, they are both nylon straps with windlasses to tighten. And that's the key thing. If a tourniquet doesn't have a windlass or say like a ratchet system to tighten it down, I'm simply not going to mess with it because there's too many issues further on down the line that the lack of having that is going to cause some serious problems, that I just prefer windlass or ratchet driven tourniquets because you can tighten them down later without having to completely undo everything you've already done. So the combat application tourniquet is nylon with a bunch of plastic, and the Gen 6s are still currently, there's been several generations of these since the first ones were created. They were created long before the TCCC program was even created. They just simply happened to look at it and see that it worked and went with it. And since then, North American Rescue has improved the design several times in what they've gotten from people in after action reviews and such. To kind of improve it. And one of the big things that you talked about in your previous episode was using soft tees on legs because cats can break. Well, one of the things that they improved was the thickness of the windlass with the Gen 7 so that you wouldn't necessarily have that issue. They improved some of the physical properties of it to make it a little bit easier to grip when your hands are slippery, which they will be when blood's involved. Which is another reason why I do not recommend people buy black gloves for anything. I don't care what you saw in Soldier of Fortune in 2011. They're not recommended for use because with black gloves, you won't be able to distinguish water from blood, from antifreeze to coolant to any of those different things. You won't be able to tell what's what just because of that black will hide a lot of the stuff. So like the basic medical gloves you can buy them at Sam's Club, Walmart. You might have to double up, but North American Rescue has fixed their issue with the bear claws and came out with some newer ones that are tan instead of the black. But somehow the black ones were still in the supply system when I was overseas and we were getting those. I was pulling them out of our guys' CLS bags that they were getting, and I was telling them, just use them for PMCS. That's the only thing they're good for.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when you made that point when you were teaching class, and that's absolute spot on, because you know, like overseas dealing with IEDs, blast injuries, so on and so forth, you might have a guy who's been blown up and he's got all those contaminants from his environment on him.
Yep.
While you're trying to search for those injuries, you know, so I mean, it happened to me, you know. One of the ice I got blown up in, I had some antifreeze and, you know, I had some coolant and some other stuff that was on me. There was roofing tar that was involved and, you know, not getting specific to what all happened, but it was, you know, I had all that stuff, you know, so it was, that was real world. I mean, and I wasn't busted up too bad from that one, but, some of the other guys were, you know, and so when we're applying that buddy aid, that is, you know, and all of a sudden you're throwing on a pair of black nitrile gloves, man, you don't know what you're getting on you, especially when there's flash burns and everything else. And so anyway, not to get on a tangent, but yeah, man, and people really need to know the difference between the tourniquets that are out there, because there's a lot of good products. There's a lot. There's even more decent products, and then there's a bunch of shit.
Oh yeah,
and, there's, you know, there's a bunch of sales gimmicks, and you know, I'm not gonna stake my life on a sales gimmick.
Yeah,
it has to work.
One of the being National Guard, one of the guys in my platoon, he is a deputy for one of the counties close to where I'm at, and he's. Because of his background and what he does in the Guard, he's on the SWAT team. And we were talking one day, and he brought up that one of the saley gimmicky one tourniquets are actually the ones that his department bought for use, because they believe it's easier to use on pediatrics and it's easier to use on dogs and all of this other crap that's out there. And that's one of the things I try to dispel in my classes, that those are sale gimmicks and something that's trying to sell itself as a $20 replacement for a $2 ACE wrap, in addition to somehow providing enough pressure to being a tourniquet, is garbage. Cause those are two very, very separate tools that I want two very separate things to do. So like I said, the cat is it's a plastic windlass. Yes. I've never seen one break in training, and I have cranked them down on people, done a live tissue lab. I've never seen one break during a live tissue lab. Granted, these were all Gen 7s. I haven't heard a lot about Gen 6s breaking either. I've used those for the majority of my training iterations and classes and going through the medic schoolhouse and all of that. I've never seen one break. And every single time I put a tourniquet on, it's been to occlude blood flow. It's never been – excuse me. It's never been to just kind of throw one on real quick to make it look good for the instructor. Every single one was fully tight and blood flow was occluded. The soft T has a little bit more metal.
Right.
The soft T wide is actually what I carry on my person every day, including at home and when I'm at my civilian job, just simply because it folds down a little thinner and it's a little bit easier to carry on your person. Not from I'm trying to hide from people that I carry a tourniquet, but I can just drop this in a pocket and forget about it without having to worry about, you know, a lot of different things that I might potentially have to worry about with a cat, because it is a little bit larger when it comes to form factor, just in size. But, the soft D is what I carry. I use that in conjunction with a Filster flat pack. It's a little piece of injection molded Kydex with some shock cord on it to hold it on. So that way I don't have to use the bungee cords that it comes with. So that way I can just grab the two little loops that clip back on, pop it off, and then I have the tourniquet ready for use. But that's what I carry every single day in my pocket. I like them both for two very different reasons, but I would not be afraid to use either one in a situation where somebody needed a tourniquet. Sadly, I do not have any time on any of the other tourniquets outside of the emergency medical technician tourniquet, the one that looks like a BP cuff with a metal clamp. I actually was fortunate enough to get my hands on one, and my platoon sergeant from the medical platoon saw how intrigued I was with it and gave it to me. So I have that with me. I will be taking it to the next class I teach to show it as another option that is COTSI recommended. They're more for like a clinical side, but that thing is 4 inches wide. There are no questions about that thing, including blood flow, because that's pretty much similar to what they use in a surgical setting to occlude blood and to prevent blood flow on an appendage when they perform surgery. It's something similar to that, and it that sucker works. It just takes up a lot of space.
They're not small. No. But so would be something you would put in a of care bag. So you're a medic by training. You're a 68 whiskey. You're a field medic. And I can say from the class that you taught, you're a very, very talented and very professional about your approach to it. I've met some medics that is a little questionable, like, is this guy, you know, maybe we ought to put you in the aid station for a while. But guys that you want to have on your team, it's very apparent. But with that said, you know, a good 68 whiskey is going to have his preferences for what goes in to his aid bag that he has on his back. And so for you, what would be your approach to that, and what would you recommend go in it?
So for as far as tourniquets are concerned, for my aid bag, I just simply prefer the CAT. Just for ease of use, not necessarily for myself, but for other people, if I'm having someone else assist me, it might not be the CLS or one of the several CLS that I was fortunate enough to have. We were very CLS heavy in my platoon, being a mechanized mortar platoon. We were never attached to anybody. And I remember vividly during NTC, for anyone that listens that has been there or has any sort of infantry experience, we ended up as the frontline trace for our battalion. As the mortar platoon, which is not supposed to happen for those of you that haven't been in that experience. Medics are not, or mortars are not supposed to be the farthest person forward in any situation, especially not in aluminum tin cans.
No.
So with us being where we are in the situation, it works that way. Sometimes it does. In that situation, and it especially bleeds over to the partisan environment where you don't have a lot of support. You're not always going to be with the people that you plan to be with, and the plan is a plan in name only. It rarely ever works the way you want it to. I prefer the CAT because it's the easiest to have someone use with as little training as possible. It really does. It's almost intuitive to put a CAT on another person. With 30 minutes of training, someone is pretty much guaranteed to be very proficient in using a combat application tourniquet as opposed to a soft TY. As much as I love it, the only reason I carry it on my person, like I said, is because of form factor. If I could get away with carrying a CAT, just as ease of use alone, I would. Again, like I said, not because I'm concerned about my ability to put something on. I'm concerned about someone else's ability to put something on. So my aid bag has nothing but combat application tourniquets. If I was running low and it was all I could get out of the supply system, I would have absolutely no issue running softies. But I trained my guys on them. I had them get used to and familiar with them because another class that I taught before I taught my first pay-to-play course, there was an individual there that was a staff NCO currently actively serving with the Marine Corps that was there, and all his platoon had was nothing but soft tees. because on their last deployment, they replaced or they ran into a soft unit, and that was all they had. And they were like, hey, we ain't going to use them. They're brand new in the package. Here you go. And coming from a prior service Marine Corps, that's a really big thing when you get brand new equipment like that. It's something you hold on to. So that is still equipment to this day that that unit still has. And I was telling our guys that I was like, look, this isn't something we normally have in our supply system. Granted, yes, they are in the system, but the chances of us getting them is when we just order CATs, because it's the one everyone is the most familiar with, is slim to none. However, the chance of us rolling up on another unit or assisting another unit, you know, either non-guard or non-army entirely, are high, that we might not run into the exact same stuff that we've trained with. And there's a chance that if I can find these things now and get you guys that experience, it's going to be better than trying to figure out how to use them now. And trying to figure out how to use them exactly on the spot, like when you need it. One of the quotes that has always stuck with me, especially when it comes to training, is that the parking lot is not the place to learn how to fight when you're getting the crap beaten out of you.
Dude, that is true. That is true, man. And you never pass up equipment, you know, because it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's medical equipment, whether it's technical equipment, radio equipment, you know, arms, ammunition, whatever it is, you have to familiarize yourself with it. It's not enough, no matter what the topic is, it is not enough to just sit it in the corner and say, okay, I got it. Well, you know, you have no idea what you actually have, how to use it, the ins and outs of it, the points of failure of your equipment, which is a big one that a lot of people have problems with. And, you know, how to make that work as a system in conjunction with other pieces of kit as well. And part of that, a big part of that that you brought up in class up here, was the use of Kovan bandages, the Kovan wrap. If you want to elaborate on that, I think the listeners would appreciate it.
Okay, so Kovan, that kind of leads us into a little bit of what we were going to get ready to talk about next anyway, continuing on that line of an IFAC and what to pack into it. I don't want to get lost on that, because it is a very important thing, because there's a lot of crap and disinformation out there that I want to try to fix. So after we've done our massive hemorrhage and we've done the airway, which is for most people that I'm talking to right now, nothing more than an MPA, you go into respirations, and that's simply a chest seal or some sort of occlusive dressing. And then for those that do know and that are trained on it, there's a tension pneumothorax treatment, which is a needle, but that is several steps down the line. That is not the initial treatment for when you see it, because most of the times you're going to have a chest seal on there already for that to cause and that to happen. And it's just a 14-gauge needle that is at least 3.25 inches long. 14-gauge or 10-gauge, because, again, medicine is constantly changing, and that's one of my big things. It changes everywhere. And that goes back to the rumors that I talked about at the beginning. One of the big ones is you can use a tampon to plug a gunshot wound. And while technically, yes, you can fill that cavity that you see at the beginning with the tampon, you're not doing anything with it. And a lot of that comes back to, well, you know, medics in Vietnam, you know, they did this and they did that. Okay, well, I'm pretty sure we're not doing heart surgery the same way we did in 1965. Things have changed since then. We've learned better. One of the big ones that's coming about now is that normal saline, what we call affectionately in the medical community as Posta water, is terrible for people that have really low blood pressure because they've bled out a lot. It's got some pH issues. It doesn't transport oxygen. It doesn't transport waste. It's really terrible. So one of the big things that we're pushing right now is you know, walking blood banks. And the Rangers have been really, really, really good about it. They have actually dropped their preventable death rate on the battlefield to 0%. Which is an extremely rare thing because the rest of the military, some soft units included, is still at 25%. But the Rangers have been able to knock it down with their they teach everybody CLS stuff, and they've been doing that for years. And then the Ranger Blood program that they have has definitely played a huge part in that, because Rangers definitely have one foot in the soft community and one foot in the regular Army community. And they like to play both sides when it benefits them, for sure.
Right.
But they've been really big on that, and that is one of the things that I feel like the rest of the Army and the rest of the military in a whole, and even preppers as general, can look at and kind of strive to look for that as guidance. Is you don't have to wait for a CLS class to teach people medical skills. You don't have to wait for, you know, paying to go to a course. And that was one of the things I tried to strive with my course, is that, you know, not everybody has the opportunity or the financial ability to be able to afford to come out to a class that even I teach, let alone some of the extremely much better instructors that are out there teaching medical information to regular people. So my thought process is, well, I need to train you to understand this information so well that you can go back to your groups and push that information down upon everybody else.
Right.
It's like most military courses, they're train the trainer courses, so that way you can take that information back to your unit and better the whole unit with it. So we've done the covered any gaping holes with a chest seal. If you have a buildup of air in between your lungs and the rest of your body, we've gotten rid of that with a needle. So now we're on down to the C, which is circulation. So from here, we're going to look at any tourniquets we placed earlier in massive hemorrhage. And we're going to look at them and make a determination as to whether or not they really require a tourniquet, and we were just a little overzealous with the placement, or if they really do require that and that needs to stay. If they don't, and we were a little overzealous and we just saw blood and slapped a tourniquet on, maybe we can go ahead and reduce that down to just a pressure dressing with an Israeli, or we can sit there and look at it and go, you know, I could probably get away with packing this, and now the rest of his limb can get blood flow back to it, because when you first apply that tourniquet, it's going to be really high and tight, very as high up onto the appendage as you can get it. And the idea is let's say, you know, someone gets a gunshot wound to the calf, and we put a tourniquet high up really close to the hip, well, there's that whole section between mid-calf and hip that's full of blood from all those vessels that isn't being utilized. So maybe we can get that back into the circulatory system doing what it's supposed to do, providing oxygen, removing waste, thermoregulating, all the different great things that our blood and our body does.
Right.
So we're going to go ahead and pack that wound. Well, after we've packed that wound, we don't want to sit there like an idiot, you know, in a battlefield and putting our hand and holding pressure on that gauze that we've put directly to the source of bleeding, because that's my big issue with Red Cross first aid courses, is they say direct pressure works. Well, technically direct pressure does, but it's not on the wound, it's on the source of the bleeding. And that's the thing that they don't talk about, that gets me into arguments with people on the internet that think that them being a babysitter for 3 years means that they know more than me as a medic. Because, you know, direct pressure is supposed to work. And if the gauze soaks with blood, you're just supposed to put more gauze on top of that. You don't need to remove it because you're removing the clot. If there's blood soaking through it, there's no clot. I'm sorry to break that that holy grail of Red Cross first aid. And it was the same stuff I was taught when I was a Boy Scout growing up, was that, you know, oh, well, if you remove the gauze that's already saturated with blood, you remove the clot. And I was, at the time, with my limited knowledge, hey, that makes sense. But if you really stop and think about it with a physiology background, and you really stop and think about what a blood clot is and what it means, if there's a blood clot, there's no more bleeding. So if there's still blood coming out, there's no clot, and if there is, it's not doing anything. I understand the thought you're trying to make, where the first clot is the best clot, and that's some sciencey stuff that I get into in the class. If you want to learn about that, come and take a class with me or somebody else that knows more than I do. You're going about it the completely wrong way, holding pressure directly over the wound itself that you can see out in the open on the surface of the skin doesn't do anything for your patient, and you're actually making things worse. So you're going to stuff that gauze, not a tampon, but, you know, actual either gauze or Curlex, if you have it, Quick Clot or any of the other commercial off-the-shelf systems that have that are impregnated with something. Because we don't use loose powder anymore. I don't care what you learned from Shooter with Mark Wahlberg. That powder went away about 2008 when a bunch of flyboy medics with swoopier hair than I have found out that it flies into their eyes under the blast of a propeller. And that was when, after that, yep. plus the fact that you can't really pack that powder to the wound, the Army realized that what they were doing was stupid and they should switch yep. to impregnated gauze instead of just the loose powder. And no, quick clot, the gauze, does not burn you, unlike quick clot, the powder. That's why the gauze, the main ingredient that most people don't know about, is nothing more than kaolin clay. It's used for all sorts of things outside of stopping bleeding. They use it for makeup and all sorts of other stuff. It's clay. Clay doesn't expire. The sterility of the product does. So if you have some quick clot back from your Army days that are expired, it's still good to leave in a kit because you're probably getting antibiotics anyway when you get it put in you. So that yeah. or some sort of cotton bandage roll. I have some here sitting next to me that I literally bought at Walmart. I think it was like $2.50 at most. What you're looking for the size is 4.5 inches by 4 yards. That's kind of the standard that we use in the medical field is that's pretty generally Curlex. There are some vacuum formed ones that you can get from H&H and North American Rescue and several other manufacturers out there, but you can get regular Curlex at Walmart for $2.50 and it'll serve your purpose. Make sure you at least get two, at least. So going on to the Coban thing, which you originally asked about, is we need to provide pressure so that we can move the patient. We can do other things around them, move on to other injuries, move on to other patients that we might have. We don't know what the situation is going to give us. So we need to find something that will provide pressure. And the one that everyone in the military looks to, much to the marketing success of the company that makes this product, is the ETB or the Israeli dressing. There are several versions of this across different manufacturers.
Oh yeah.
And they work great for that one specific intended purpose. That's why I love throwing them in IFACs, especially if you have a medic with you, because that's all that thing is going to be used for, is that one singular specific goal of applying pressure to gauze that is packed into a wound track. And that's it. That's all we're expecting it to do, because all we're packing our IFACs with is life-saving interventions. And that's it. Nothing more. No Band-Aids, no Neosporin, no aspirin. No safety pins for, I don't know what people think they can use with safety pins for, outside of like pinning triangle bandages together, because you're not pushing it through someone's tongue.
Yeah.
Another myth I wish would go ahead and die. And a lot of other things that randomly I see all across the internet in IFACs that are not life-saving interventions. And that's what we're focusing on with this. And it doesn't have to be as big as you see some of these IFACs. They can be really, really small in form factor. I have one from a company that I don't want to bring their name up because I really don't support them anymore because of things the owner has said. But there are several other companies that make a version of this product similar to that. And it's basically a med shingle that you can slide into a 2 or 3 mag, pocket, either for like M4s or AKs. I've actually even found one that I packed together very similar to the one that I have in my bump in the night home defense kit that I grab anytime I grab my rifle. I've actually been able to make it fit into a USGI bandolier, like the 3-pocket 6-mag ones they issue at SIF. I was able to make mine fit in that, and that's designed for 2 magazines yeah. to go into, and the only thing that doesn't have in it is a tourniquet.
Cool.
There are a lot of other companies. Tactical right. Taylor makes one. And I'm really not trying to dig into the specifics of gear because there's a lot of different stuff out there. And some of the cheaper routes are really the government surplus model. There's the tried and true tested method of the 100-round saw pouch with that weird insert that they developed. It's not the best, but it works, and it's pretty inexpensive out there on eBay. That's actually what I run on my main if the world ends. Kit is one of those pouches because it's inexpensive, it's easy to throw together, and it simply works. There are better options out there, but for my level and what I'm trying to get done, it fits the bill pretty perfectly. So we need to provide pressure onto that wound. So you can use a Israeli, like I was saying, you can use a one of the H&H products that are excellent, or you can simply use a 6-inch ace wrap or elastic bandage, as the Walmart brand likes to call them, that you can get at Walmart for $1.20 or a piece of Coban if it's not in an IFAC. Because one of the issues with Coban that people don't realize is that if it's compressed and heated, like many things are that we throw in our kit that we take out to the range to go sit and provide range coverage with, or just doing day-to-day things, it'll get hot. And with that compression, it'll pretty much destroy it to where it doesn't work anymore. So I love Cobain in a clinical setting. It's great after you've pulled a vial of blood off somebody and you want to keep that blood from leaking out all over anywhere. You take a little 2x2 and you fold that up and put it up on where you put the needle on, and then wrap that with a little bit of Cobain, and it works great. Or if you're working in and out of a guerrilla hospital or anything like that, then Cobain works great. But for an IFAC, if you're trying to save some money, instead of buying an $8 Israeli, you can go ahead and buy a 6 or a 4-inch ace wrap for $2 at Walmart and buy the off-brand because it's pretty much the same thing. And don't go to Walgreens because they're going to charge you $12 for this. I know. I've looked. It's one of the things I try to do is keep an eye on how much things cost, because medical is one of the things that you really kind of have to pay to play. And if I can try to decrease that cost in what it costs me to develop kits together to teach other people, I can pass that on with what I charge for a course and make it a little bit easier. And then you can look at that and go, oh, wow, you know, we used ace wraps in the class and saw that they provided more than enough pressure to stop the bleeding. I don't have to buy, you know, 15 ace or 15 Israelis at $10 a pop and spend $150. I can buy, you know, 30 Israelis at $2 a pop and only spend $60. And really save some money.
And you know, I mean, budget is a concern for all of us. We have so much stuff that we have to, you know, pick up out of pocket and things we're saving for, and you can't forget family life and family needs as well. So anywhere you can save a few dimes but have a good product, you know, that's really the name of the game, man.
Yeah. And like I was saying, I still do like Cobain. It really just depends on what you're using that product for. And that's one of the things, is that there are a lot of things that are multi-purpose, but it really depends on what your scope and what your point of view, your point of reference, basically, for context. Depends on your context as to what that product is going to make sense. Because like you were saying with the AR pistol, makes a lot of sense as a truck gun. It really does. But as a, you know, hey, stuff's popping off and we got to go, you know, hook and jab and do some stuff, might not be my first go-to, depending on your job, however, because that really depends in the size, the amount of people, what you're doing, what's going on. Because I can say, coming from my point of view, being, you know, active duty and deployed and all of this, man, it would have been great a lot of times to have a little 10.5 M4 instead of my full 14.5 as a medic, because my point of view isn't necessarily hooking and jabbing. If it has to, I will go in and go ahead and support that role because that's my primary job as a warfighter. But day to day, in and out, what I'm primarily doing, I already have a pistol anyway. I don't need a full-size rifle in addition to that, trying to prevent me from doing my ins and outs. It's a little different than what an infantryman would perform and what they require. These different tasks have different packing lists for a very specific reason. But the Cobain is great. It works well, especially for a static position, for things like that, for an IFAC. I would go ahead and say get the Israeli if you already have one, put it in there. But if not, you're not going to go wrong with a ace wrap. Just make sure you go ahead and you throw away those little metal, like sheet metal clip things they put in there to hold it down. Because even for using it to wrap joints and ankles, they don't work. That's another thing I never see in IFACs that you can purchase online outside of like North American Rescue. Like for some of those weird like secondary companies, the ones you find on Amazon, there's never anything larger than 1-inch tape.
Yeah.
And that's a personal sore spot with me. At least 2-inch wide tape. Just for the multitude of things you can do with it. So we provided that pressure on that dressing. If you want to learn how to do that, come to one of my classes. Shameless plug. I'm not afraid of it. So we've put pressure on that gauze. We've prepared that bleeding. So now after C, we're moving on to head and everything else. Well, sadly, we've run out of room in our IFAC because head and everything else head hypothermia and everything else really isn't so much of life-saving interventions that you can pack into an IFAC, because it's just not realistic for what you can effectively use in that situation. So I'll go ahead and put away this bump in the night kit. But what I will grab that does have stuff for H and every for head hypothermia and everything else is my CAR kit, because those are things I do expect to see for what I plan on using. My bump in my night, I'm already in my house. If there is hypothermia that I need to treat for whatever reason, say I, you know, I catch a round from the guy that was breaking into my house to steal my TV, well, guess what? I can just crank the AC and wrap myself in one of the blankets that's either on my couch or on my bed. I ain't got nothing to worry about. But if I pull over on the side of the road in a, you know, as much as we like to joke that the South gets really hot, it does also get really cold. And it also doesn't need to be cold to cause hypothermia. You start losing blood, and even regardless of losing blood, I have seen people lifeguarding with the Boy Scouts in the middle of July get hypothermia. It's possible. It just depends on what you're doing. I'm going to pull out my CAR kit, and one of the things that I have in that I love and that I tell everyone to buy for something to throw in their vehicle because it's so multi-purpose is a Survive Outdoors Longer survival blanket. These are not the normal, like, 99-cent survival blankets you can buy from Koglin's or whoever else, the cheap Chinese aluminum foil ones that rip as soon as you try to open them.
Yeah.
These ones are printed. They're basically really similar to Mylar. They're like an aluminum foil that's been pressed onto some sort of plastic. They're very durable. They're multi-use. Hell, the bag has a Ziploc on it, so that after you open it, you can reseal it and close it and not worry about the blanket coming out of the bag that you bought it in, because they keep that in mind that you're potentially going to reuse this product. They're very durable. You can use it to create shelter, as a ground tarp to cover stuff, and then primarily what I would use it for is first aid. And these are already from the factory designed for two people. So you can fit a lot of – there are some larger people out there that we don't necessarily want to freeze to death, because when you start looking at, you know, even just losing a pint of blood, that really seriously affects your ability for your body to thermoregulate. So we need to try to prevent that. And you know, one of the things I talk about in my classes is that and the same thing I try to keep those – certain things similar across the board. And it was the same thing I told my guys. I was like, if you bring me a litter that doesn't already have a space blanket or one of the hypothermia prevention kits that we have for North American Rescue, if I get a litter that doesn't have that on that, after we get that patient on the bird, I'm going to fight you. And I know anatomy. I'm going to hit you in some not so nice places. Do not put a patient on a litter of any kind without some sort of way to warm them, because we're putting them on the litter as soon as possible because we might have to move them in a hurry. But not only that, we want to try to, one, get them off the ground because we want to prevent that source of hypothermia. And we also want to wrap them up in something because we don't know what the weather is going to be outside. It might be really, really windy, and that can really cool people really, really quickly, let alone from the fact that you add in that they've lost 1 to 2 liters of blood. That can really start to play into that effect, and we're trying to prevent that lethal or that death spiral from starting.
Right. You know, and one thing that I'll add on that is that you have to insulate them both from the ground, from the air underneath them, as well as on top. I've seen it in classes when I was in the Army that, you know, guys are going through CLS or they're going through TC3 or one of the pilot programs that became other stuff later on. But we called it DMOC. It was called DMOC back then. We were doing a live tissue lab. You know, and they're already under stress and they're just going to lay a space blanket over the top of the casualty. They still have thermal loss into the ground.
Expert, you
put them on a litter, they still have thermal loss. And they didn't they weren't thinking through the steps was the issue. They were just like, oh crap, I need to do this, and they get that deer in headlights look, and it's like, all right, look, you know, you have to create an insulating layer on both sides of your casualty, kind of. And I always like using the hot pocket analogy, like you slide that hot pocket in the little foil, you know, mm-hmm. and then microwave it. It you're doing the same thing with a casualty.
Exactly. And so, like, in conjunction with that one in my car that I keep in my car, people that have you know, been there, done that, they'll notice that I just had a space blanket. I didn't have anything to provide warming. Well, yeah, because if I'm rolling up on an accident, I have my car that has a working heating system. So I'll crank the heat, wrap them up in that blanket, and throw them in the car. And that'll provide that active warming that we're trying to provide, because there are two different kinds of warming. There's passive and active warming. Passive warming is you're trying to use their body heat to heat them, and active warming is you're using something else to heat them back up. So that's where that old, going back to that Red Cross first aid class, that skin-to-skin contact, that's actually a thing. And that's where that comes from, is it's active warming. Yeah, you're yeah. using yourself to reheat the patient, because they've, you know, gone so far hypothermic that they aren't producing any body heat at all. And we're trying to bring that back up. And that's as far as a all service members, as far as what would everybody have, those are pretty much the basic things. There are some other things like eye shields and some other marketing crap that kind of worked its way in that I'm not 100% on, but I'm only an EMT, so what do I know? But if you want to include some of those extra things in there, that is something for you and your group to have a talk about. There are certain situations where an eye shield makes perfect sense. There are other circumstances where I can argue I can do the same exact thing with a roll of Curlex. But hey, it's your money. You spend it where you want to. I'm not going to argue with you on that. And then everything after that kind of, once you start getting outside of the IFAC, then you kind of get into the, okay, well, do you necessarily know how to use that piece of equipment? Because that's going to be something you're going to be using on someone else. The IFAC is for you or someone else to use on you. And as far as the use on you, I really don't see most people doing anything outside of throwing a tourniquet. It really doesn't happen. There's not a lot of evidence of people packing their own wound, because it's just simply not realistic, because that's a very extremely painful thing. If you've ever had like a boil or an abscess or something that had to be lanced, and they use that little like quarter or eighth inch gauze and pack only like an inch and a half into it, and you're screaming out of terror and you know, begging them to stop. Well, we're taking 4.5 inches and 4 yards. Yeah. Of gauze and packing that into a wound, it's going to feel a whole lot worse. So I really don't see people doing that on their own. But as far as an IFAC, again, it goes back to life-saving interventions. Stop. If you want anything else, throw that in your assault pack or in your ruck. Because, yeah, you should have, like, some Band-Aids, some Neosporin, because, like, infection killed more people during the Civil War than actual bullet wounds. That's a thing. Infection is something we're going to need to worry about, especially when we get away from the heavy antibiotic usage and the targeted antibiotic theory that we currently are blessed with right now with our system. You start looking down to the, okay, well, all we have is fish mox and fish cillin. And, well, hey, there's this guy that's allergic to amoxicillin and penicillin, which is even a thing that happens in the military. I had a guy have a list of 4 antibiotics that he was allergic to. And I was like, well, shit. That's like everything we have. And even in certain clinics, they really don't carry a lot of stuff, because it's a cost factor that they have to look into for, you know, the what things are they primarily going to see, what people are they primarily going to look into, and what are the drugs that handle the most amount of things. That's why, you know, docs are most credited with us saying, hey, take a knee, drink water, change your socks, and have a Motrin. Because most people are pretty terrible about doing at least 2 of those things, and the third one covers so many different types of injuries that it would be stupid for the military to not, you know, basically buy stock in Motrin with the amount that we've purchased.
Cures everything, man.
Oh yeah.
You know, ibuprofen, acetaminophen, take enough of it, cures everything.
Well, they've actually
that and IV, dude.
There's actually been some studies that have come out that have said, ironically enough, and I know you would get a kick out of this, they've actually found that any more than 400 milligrams of ibuprofen has no positive effect on you. You lose therapeutic effect after 400 milligrams.
I don't
milligrams.
Doubt it, man.
But it's just so cheap for us to purchase those 800 milligrams. Yeah. We just pump them out and toss them at people like they're – it's not been uncommon for people to tell me. They were like, hey, man, I need like 3. And I was like, you can take one, and then in 8 hours you can take another one. And they were like, well, I need – and I was like, I'm going to turn around, and what you do with your meds are you and your kidneys problem. And I've watched people take like three and down it with a monster. It doesn't do anything, but it, you know, it's a bit of that placebo effect. They think that, you know, they're outsmarting the medical system and the doc and the PA that's, you know, been to school longer than they've been in the Army, and they think they're outsmarting us.
Whatever, whatever gets them through, especially, especially downing it with a monster, man. That is, there was a time that I was convinced that Monster, between Monster stateside and Rip It overseas.
Oh yeah.
Big difference. Like the closet sponsors of GWAT. Mm-hmm. Like had to have been because
now the big one for
like in Honus. Yeah.
Oh yeah, my generation now it's Bang and Rain are the current sponsors, because you got all those BCAAs and the creatine and the 300 milligrams of caffeine as opposed to the like 150 that you thought was a big deal for Monster. You're putting out 150 milligrams of caffeine. Bang came out and was like, yo, hold my beer, watch this. Here's twice that at 300. Plus BCAAs, taurine, all this other crap in it. And you're like, I could stay awake for 36 hours right now. And then you down four cans.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it, man.
Things change. Things stay the same.
Such a wonderful lifestyle.
Oh, yeah.
But so kind of rounded things out here. What training do you suggest from basic to advanced?
So I'll go ahead and set a limit on this on up to like a CLS or a medic light, because anything after that requires stuff with like people with letters behind their names. For like the very basic absolute bare minimum, I would say that people can go ahead and go find, you can look for these online, the Stop the Bleed program. I also am a instructor for that, if anyone's curious. However, to not so quite shamelessly plug myself, those are free classes. They cost you, you know, free 90 free. They cost you absolutely nothing but the gas to get to the class. If someone is trying to charge you for a class, they're technically not supposed to, per the Stop the Bleed program, and they're not supposed to attribute themselves with it. But you can look online. I think it's stopthebleed.org. They have a function on the website where you can go and search for a class near you. I think it's the whole month of March, if I'm correct. I might be mistaken on that. I do believe it's the entire month of March is Stop the Bleed month. So that's when primarily the most courses are going to be held. But again, I could be wrong on that one. They hold classes throughout the year. I've taught several classes for Stop the Bleed that were not in Stop the Bleed month or even on Stop the Bleed day. But that's a big basic class. It's an hour to 2 hour course that focuses on preventing massive hemorrhage from killing someone. So tourniquets and wound packing. There is a group called First Care Provider that kind of took it a little bit further and went along the lines of the All Service Members course and included like chest seals and hypothermia management into it, because those classes were being taught and kind of pushed as a, hey, since we have, and these are not me saying this, but this is what's coming from the people that started the course. So let's not get this mixed up or anybody calling me out for saying this. Since we have, and again, this is a quote, all of these mass shootings going on, it was started by the Hartford, Connecticut. It was a bunch of doctors that came together and they said, look, outside of politics, there has to be something that we can do to try to stem the life that is being lost from this. And it's a really, really good program that I believe in heavily, which is why I'm an instructor, because, you know, there's so many times when like, hey, a dude with like my car bag worth of stuff or even just a basic IFAC could really save a lot of lives. When you look at certain situations and certain instances of what was going on, just kind of pushing that, like, look how far and how much they pushed CPR or to babysit someone's kid. It's pretty much a non-starter if you don't have a CPR class. But what they don't tell you is there's only like a 0.7% survival rate for out of hospital initiated CPR. Well, we have a pre-hospital death rate or a preventable death rate of 25% for trauma. And trauma is the single largest cause of death in the U.S. for people under the age of 44. And that's what this course was trying to, in addition to the not to get into the political side of these doctors, but outside of the mass shooting thing, is like, look, out, you know, 44 and younger, your biggest cause of death is trauma in the U.S. There's got to be something we can do to stop that. Everybody knows CPR, right. And that's only a 0.7% chance that it's even going to work. And even now they're telling people to do CPR without even worrying about doing the breaths. So it's a 2-hour course. It doesn't even cost you anything. CPR costs people like $30 to $50 to take. This is a free class that you can take. I'm an instructor. You can hit me up if you live in the North Carolina region at all, or even in like Eastern Virginia or parts of South Carolina. I might be convinced if you have enough people to make it worthwhile for me to take to teach the class. Hell yeah, I'll teach it to you. I'm all about teaching those classes. They're, like I said, a huge thing that I believe in. But it's really hard to get people to take a class for that. But the next up from there would probably be something from either myself, my TCCC, which I'm probably going to work on renaming along to the all service members. I'll try to find a name that works within the prepper group or the that prepper mindset. But just a good basic, like, how do you plug a hole? How do you throw a tourniquet, a chest seal, going over how to pack an IFAC if you've never gone over one, going over some other different little basics, and then plugging that into a bigger group, because you can't just have someone that knows these basics in your group if stuff really pops off. Because, yeah, I mean, granted, I'm a medic, but like someone comes in and has some pretty serious, like, actual, like, health things wrong with them, I'm kind of at a loss, because my skill set and my scope of practice is so small that, like, I'm not the one to sit there and brag and be like, yo, if you've got something wrong, you know, I can replace a doctor. Like, no. There are several times where I'm looking to help from people with, like, a paramedic license, because there are things that I simply just do not know. It's not something we're trained for. It's not something that the Army sees important for me to learn, because it really isn't. You just can't replace a doctor or a PA, and those people are really important, and they don't have to be in your direct area, because to plug one of your courses, you know, you get somebody with an HF radio and some digital radio setup, you can do a lot for bringing back the olden days where, you know, back in the West, docs never just sat in one town. They would make a travel on a wagon and go all over the place. Right. So if you have some people that have my skill knowledge or a little bit lower skill knowledge, or even like a CNA health knowledge, and a doctor comes into town, but you've already talked to them, you know, 3 days prior about what this guy had over HF and NVIS, and they have an idea of what they're coming into, and they've already talked to you about a treatment plan, and you've done a little bit of telemedicine, you can really set that patient up for success with you not knowing a whole lot. And that's where those comms really, really come into play when it comes into medicine. So again, going from a stop the bleed to like something like my class, or like a Dark Angel Medical, or I think it's Lone Star Medics down in Texas. They teach a bunch of crap like that. Not crap, but a bunch of like they teach a few of the medical courses. Sadly, they limit some of their courses to people with credentials and people with badges and stuff. And I won't get into that, because that's a whole separate, entirely different discussion. But they do have some stuff they teach to regular people and to average everyday individuals that are curious about that stuff. After that, if there's stuff that you want to learn, honestly, I'm going to tell you to start looking at, like, for stuff that you'll be able to have an impact into, start looking at Wilderness EMT and Wilderness First Responder, because that the physical things that you're going to have to deal with are going to be, you know, joint injuries and different cleanliness and hygiene issues that you don't think of. You haven't been in the backcountry for a week living out of a rucksack. And those classes are going to give you that perspective and give you that knowledge and that skill base that most people outside of the military or outside of the backpacking community simply aren't going to have. And those are things that I don't see being pushed enough when it comes in this community. Our classes like that, because there really is a lot of important stuff in those classes that people don't talk about, things like preventing infection when, you know, you don't have a whole bunch of rubbing alcohol, but you might have a little bit of bleach and a little bit of baking soda, and you can make some Dakin solution and you can clean the hell out of some stuff with some Dakin solution. And it's really little what you need. Yeah. And, you know, even going to what SF have found and the CPGs, which is stuff I'll give to you to put in the notes. This is all stuff for, you know, a medic being responsible for a patient for a day to 3 days to 2 weeks without a provider, and it includes telemedicine stuff. Yeah. There's a cheat sheet for you to use for creating your FL8 Digi message, for sending up to a doc, all that stuff that you can use from the military and kind of mold it into what works for us. And it includes Dakin solution, talks about what it is, how, not really how it works, but, and they've even found that just using water that's clean enough to drink is just as effective as you know, your grandma, your parents back in the day holding you under the sink and pouring hydrogen peroxide over it. You know, with the great fix-all, hydrogen peroxide and Neosporin, you know, they really only do so much. Right. But and Dakin Solutions is a really cheap thing. And, you know, with all the stuff that's going on right now with the coronavirus, and I don't want to get too much into that because, again, that's not my level of education. That's not stuff I know about. I'm just saying there are apparently a lot of people that didn't know you were supposed to wash your hands, which is really frightening. You know, all this, you know, bleach has multiple uses. And I haven't seen too much of it outside of going to Sam's Club in the big town near me. They didn't have any bleach wipes whatsoever, but they still had 3 gallon packs of Clorox bleach. So I don't understand why people are like, man, I don't have any bleach wipes. What am I going to do? But there's perfectly good bleach that you can put, dilute and put into a rag and use to disinfect surfaces. And, you know, Walmart was out of all that. Walmart was almost out of bleach. And then I went to the Dollar Tree just on a whim to see what they had. And there was gallon-sized bottles of bleach for $1, fully stocked. But that was in the small town that I live in that really isn't affected by this. I haven't seen this at the food line that's right next to my house in my tiny town of 2,000 people. Because it's outside of major cities, it's not something you see worrying people, because we're too busy worrying about paying our bills. But that, again, that's a whole separate conversation that we can get into. And it's not the actual coronavirus that people need to be worrying about. It's the second and third order effects, like Matt was talking about the other day, about like shipping and food and, you know, might potentially see some issues in the power grid, but really not so much that. It's going to be people in China that are feeling this, that we're feeling the second, third order effects, because it's not, the factories aren't shut down because, you know, people aren't showing up to work. It's people can't show up to work because the bus driver isn't showing up because they shut down buses. It's people in the ports aren't showing up to work, so they can't ship the goods that they're making out to us, because thanks to globalism, so much of our stuff is made over there that it's not even funny anymore. And I'm really hoping this kind of shows how stupid of an idea globalism is and how much nations need to be independent in case something like this were to happen again. But so after the wilderness EMT stuff, after that, you're looking at like, and I hear a lot of people online like, oh, if you want to learn how to be a tactical medic, go take a paramedic course. No, fam, that's not what that's about. Paramedic is going to teach you how to like handle a heart attack and like handle someone having a stroke and a whole bunch of other medical issues, which are important, but aren't what I deal with in my day in, day out activities when I'm wearing a multicam uniform. It's not the same thing. They're very important, and I would never try to say that I could replace a paramedic because I don't have the same skill set, but they couldn't come into my life and try to replace me because they'd be trying to hang 2 bags of normal saline wide open on a patient that is suffering from blood loss and hadn't treated the source of bleeding yet. And again, that's not a knock on them. It's because they're focused on different things than I'm focused on, and civilian EMS is trying to catch up with the military. They are really trying, but there are some dinosaurs in medicine that try to hold on to really old, outdated things. You can see it all over the place. But if you were to want to go that route, I would say like a CNA course for learning basic nursing skills, because those are things that are going to be important, because, you know, it might not be, you know, you're getting into a gunfight with the neighbors next door. It's Uncle Joe that lives 2 houses down, or, you know, your friend that lives 2 houses down isn't used to running an axe all day to power their fireplace, and they slip and cut themselves. And granted, they're not bleeding a whole lot, but now you have to worry about infection, and you can't get to the hospital because all the beds are full from coronavirus or whatever the hell is going on, and you can't get them down there to get it looked at. So you need to understand some basic nursing skills and how to keep wounds clean and how to treat them for prolonged periods to prevent them from getting that infection. So I would say like a CNA course. There's actually a really good book that I got recommended for physical examination. Is a book they give to doctors called The Bates Guide to Physical Examination and History Taking. I got the 12th edition from Amazon. There's also a pocket guide that I want to keep to throw in my dismount bag for when I do military stuff. But there's a lot of stuff in here that teaches you how to basically, like, ask someone questions about what's going on and how to look over them and how to do different examinations on people that you might not get the experience with if, you know, you're a plumber in your day-to-day life. But you want to be prepared for that situation where you have to provide some basic medical care to you and your family and those that you care about. There are a bunch of good books. I have some that I'll have to go look up that are on my Amazon wish list that I've been meaning to get that really hit that nursing thing heavily, because it's not just, you know, a nurse isn't just someone in a cute white outfit you see on Halloween all the time. Like the traditional,
those are fun.
Those are great. There are some traditional nursing skills that have really been lost by people with the advent of, and it's not to knock it, because modern medicine is great. It's amazing. I would never trade it for anything else in the world. It's one of the things that I really appreciate most, that and running water in the modern era. But there are some things that, because of that, we've lost the ability and understanding of what to do. And that's basic things like suturing and wound care and infection management. And just handling people that might not be able to take care of themselves, and like changing bedpans and like how to do sponge baths and crap like that people just don't know how to do, because when grandma and grandpa get old, we push them out to the nursing home and pay somebody else to take care of it instead of keeping them at home and knowing how to do it ourselves. And like you were saying the other day, with how far we've disassociated ourselves from death, with how, you know, someone died and they stayed in the living room for a day or two. And if someone did die, we went out, we dug the hole in the back 40, buried them, sang a couple hymns, and went on about our lives. And I you know, when we buy meat from the store, there's a little piece of basically gauze underneath of it to catch all the blood so we don't get freaked out from all that blood in our meat. There are a lot of things that we've distanced ourselves from that I really think has been not so beneficial as we thought it was to distance ourselves from. And I'll give them to you to put them in the show notes, but some of those books really kind of lay it down to those basic nursing skills that I would really would think would benefit people the most to learn and understand. I know for prepping, people have probably heard about Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy. They're great. They have a lot of information, except when it comes to my side of the house, because they still have that hospital mindset, that, you know, Red Cross first aid class for non-doctor or nurse things to do, and some of their stuff that they talk about kind of shows that, and you can see it in some of the things that they do. But when it comes to, like, you know, dealing with sickness and disease and injuries that are not life-threatening, man, I'm going to ask them questions, because that's stuff that I'm not 100% about. It's all that scope of practice and that context and what you're doing is really going to guide a lot of what you have going on.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Well, have you got any final thoughts?
Really, I can't think about it. I can't think of any right now besides take a class from you, take a class from me, take a class from somebody. Because right now there is a whole bunch of people you can hit Google or DuckDuckGo or whatever you use to search for stuff on the internet. And there are thousands of people out there online on the internet that are willing to take your hard-earned money and learn you some skills that you don't know. Learn as much as you can. There is no shortage to the breadth of knowledge that you can get right now, even just from, like, with caution, stuff like YouTube and Patreon and stuff like that. Learn you some stuff in all sorts of different things. You know, you know, me coming from, like, a medic, like, I still want to learn, you know, scouting basics and how to plan a basic, like, 2 or 3 day recon patrol, because those are things that are important to me, because I might not, you know, be right next to you if something were to pop off. I wish to God I were, because that would, you know, quell a lot of fears that I have, but it's just not realistic to go about life thinking like that. I'm going to have the people that are around me in my neighborhood, and I need to be able to know those things so I can step up and fill that void for people that might not necessarily have that understanding. And, you know, I'm still trying to learn more when it comes to mechanics and, you know, fixing my cars, when it comes to a lot of the different things that they've had wrong with them. However, at the same time, I understand my breadth of knowledge is only what it is, and the amount of tools that I can pay for on my salary are only what it are. And I still go to mechanics and things like that. But try to learn as many basic things as you can that are outside of, you know, things that, like, your grandparents used to talk about doing, you know, for people my age and stuff like that. And or your parents, or, you know, whatever it is, try to learn those older skills, you know, learn and understand how to take care of cast iron and how to cook over fire or coals, And basic stuff like that are really going to seem important, and not just from the, oh, if the world ends, but just the going out and doing those things and the people that you're going to meet doing that are going to be the most important thing in times to come.
Dude, couldn't agree more, man. I couldn't agree more. Well, hey, brother, I really appreciate it. MechMedic, if you want to give a plug for your blog, is it still up and running?
Oh, it's running. I just haven't been able to get on it. Been a little busy since coming back and everything. Got back a couple days ago from the most beautiful state in the Union, West Virginia. Spent a lot of great time up there with some family. Came down, got headed straight back into work after that, and trying to work out this new schedule. So I will get some new posts up on that. I cannot remember off the top of my head the name of that website. I think it's just MechMedic.com. I messed that up. StuckPigMedical.com. That's a name I've had in my head for a long time. That's a play on words on, if you know me personally, that's a play on words on my last name. It's been a running joke the entire time I've been in the military. But there is some good information on there, and I promise there will be some much more better information on there. You can tell I've been with grunts for a while. There will be some more information on there. I'm trying to get some videos put together because there are just some things with my limited Marine vocabulary that I just can't put into words that I feel I could be doing better justice to with a video. I will try to get those up. StuckPigMedical.com. That is my blog. Go ahead, and if you're not already, you probably already are. American Partisan and Unchained Preppers as well is a great resource. There's a lot of good people out there that know a whole lot more about a lot of things than I do.
Absolutely, brother. Hey, I am truly appreciative of this interview. I'm glad that you sat down with us for a little while and gave us your thoughts on these really important topics. But anyway, take it easy, brother.
Oh, yeah, you too, man. Anytime you want to have me on again or with some other people to talk about some stuff that's outside of my scope of view, I will gladly sit down here, drink beer, and run my mouth.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. And right on, man.
All right. Thank you, man. Later.